It is Saturday, July 19th, 2008, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, the ultimate guide to cascading style sheets and more about web development.
The bandwidth for GeekSpeak.org is provided by GNI, GNIHosting.com.
It's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP. After Geek News, we'll be talking with Tommy Olson about his newest book, The Ultimate CSS Reference, all about web development. We're also giving away some of the books. If you or someone you know is a web developer, pay attention. Later in the show, we'll be giving out two of copies of The Ultimate CSS Reference by SitePoint Press to those who answer a little quiz about today's show, so pay attention. Monday morning on Talk of the Bay, Big Sur, after the fire. As life returns to Big Sur, KUSP's Robert Poley talks to residents and fire officials about the impact of the recent wildfires and the challenges ahead. That's on Talk of the Bay Monday morning at 10 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, and he uses digital technology for less radiation, and he offers one-appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me, I have Miles Elam, student, programmer and political junkie.
Good morning, Lyle.
Ben Jaffe, slacker and media dude.
Morning.
And Ryder Brooks, support engineer at Sun Microsystems. Morning, Ryder.
Good morning.
We're going to be talking with Tommy Olson about his new book, CSS Reference, The Ultimate CSS Reference. But first, I want to do some geek news, as we do every week, and I think I will start today with Mr. Elam.
Which story would you like to hear today?
Oh, my goodness. I want to know about Spore, because I love Spore so much.
Spore is a game that is working off of the principle of evolution, that you have these natural selections. Although in this case, there's kind of an intelligent designer, presuming that you are intelligent, to design this creature.
And you just got right to the meat of that, huh? It's a game that allows you to create creatures, and you actually
modify. You start from a single-celled organism going around just trying to grab food particle or energy particles, and then as you as time goes on, you're able to become multicellular to change items, whether you're going to be more passive, whether you're going to try to eat other things.
And that game's not actually out yet. It looks really good. It's by the makers of Sim Everything, Sim Life, mm-hmm. and Sim Roller Coaster and the whole deal.
By the same creator, yeah.
Yeah, same creator. And the thing that they did first was they needed to have a whole bunch of creatures in their universe, so they produced a
creature editor.
A creature editor, which is kind of
creature
creator, which is a free application, really fun to use, and I highly recommend it if you're interested in 3D games and 3D modeling. It's a wonderful thing. It's spore.com is where you can get it, and you can create your own creature. So you start with kind of a blob, which is the body, and you can add legs to it and eyes to it and mouths and mm-hmm. all these different wings,
as many legs as you like.
Yeah,
you know, all sorts of, and as you move things around, assuming that it's a vertebrate, assuming that it has a spine, as you start bending and stretching, the system actually figures out, well, a creature that had a shape of a spine with this shape and with legs this long is going to move this way.
Right.
And so it's fairly impressive in terms of what it does with the anatomy of that creature.
So you add three legs and it kind of walks like a tripod. It's really interesting. In any case, it's fun to play with, and part of it, you create free account, and then you save your Spore creatures to this online repository. And I guess there's a lot of them?
They now have more Spore creatures in this database than the number of known species on Earth.
So virtual creatures outnumber actual creatures.
Right, variations.
Do you know the number? Is it how many million? I mean, is it? It must be a lot.
Don't know, but they did say that they had 100,000 with only the first 22 hours and a million by the end of the first week.
That's a lot of creatures. I think Spore.com actually tells you how many creatures they've got in the database at any one time. I'm clicking through. All right. Well, thank you very much, Miles, for that. And it's Spore.com. We will put that on the website, a link to it, so you can download it and try it. It works on Macintosh and Windows machines, I believe. Ryder, we haven't talked about electronic voting for a while, but what's the most recent from Diebold?
Well, there was a small press release on Thursday, and Stephen Spoonamore, who is founder of CyberInt, which is basically a security policy technical firm, very prominent in the country. He's very well known as being one of a leading authority on hacking, cyber espionage, electronics, stuff like that. A whistleblower had recently come out about a 2002 election in Georgia that was a gubernatorial and Senate election.
Okay.
And
2002.
So a while ago. And you know how these things kind of leak out over time.
What did he discover about the election?
So there was a couple of red flags that this whistleblower had noticed was that the CEO of Diebold, Bob Urshivanich, however you pronounce it, I'm going to hack it, I'm sure, and mangle it, had personally gone out to two counties that were basically Democratic strongholds in this election in Georgia.
Yeah. And in fact, the polling had showed Democratic wins.
Yes, okay. Lead polling. Those are the results of this.
Right.
But in advance of that, he had gone out to these two counties and had personally gone out to install a patch that was supposed to fix a clock problem on these Diebold systems.
Did it fix the clock problem?
Did not. The other leading flag is that it, in fact, did not actually correct the problem at all that it was designed specifically to address.
Okay.
So eventually this whistleblower had delivered this patch to Spoonamore, and he had done some analysis on it and confirmed that indeed it did not fix this clock patch, and what it appeared to have were two parallel programs of the Diebold software on the patch medium. CD or compact flash card, I'm not sure what it was. Now, he's not actually able to say why there were these two parallel programs of the software that appeared identical, but a bit unusual considering what the patch was supposed to deliver.
So is there going to be some investigation in this?
Well, he submitted the information to the Justice Department, and at this point there's been no action on it. But a lot of speculation on the results in these two counties because there were about 15 to 11 point margin in favor in the polls for the Democratic leaders,
and yet
they lost by about a 10% margin.
Did he visit any areas that the Republicans didn't win?
No, those were the only two counties that he went to.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so it's very suspicious.
Yeah.
And so he's reported this Justice Department. Not much has come of it as of yet.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that.
Yeah.
Speaking about Spore, right now at Spore.com, you can find a number of all creatures, 1,997,796. So almost 2 million creatures being created by people. Yeah. Thank you, Ryder, for that news, Myers, for that news. And I will go over to Mr. Jaffe. What's going on with the whole, Viacom wanting Google reports and logs?
Yeah, so there's a bit of a legal spat. Well, I wouldn't call it a spat. It's much more than a spat. But between Google and Viacom, and of course, so Google owns YouTube and runs YouTube. And the reason for the legal spat is all of the copyrighted material that people upload onto YouTube constantly. And Google's stance on this has always been, Google will take in your uploaded content and host it, and they will take it down if they get a takedown notice from one of these companies.
But they won't filter.
But they
if
won't.
You will.
They won't filter, and they won't have people sitting there approving every single video because
Viacom basically got a court order to get log information to find out how many people are viewing this stuff.
Yes, absolutely. So in this legal battle, Viacom has. has demanded that for access to this YouTube database with the usernames and IP addresses of every user and all of the videos that they've ever watched.
Watched, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, you can imagine that the privacy
and the
ramifications
court case
are huge.
This, right? I mean, it was part of this lawsuit.
Yeah, the
court
judge actually said do it. And
in fact,
so,
I wanted to cover this last week or 2 weeks ago when this actually broke. We just didn't get to it. But
yeah,
it's a pretty serious issue because it's a pretty privacy issue. I think of what I watch on YouTube as private information. I don't want to, you know.
And your username and your IP address as well.
Right.
And so, recently Google and Viacom reached a deal finally where Google will, give the database over with all the usernames and IP addresses obscured, but it'll have, all of the viewing history.
So that's the big win.
That's the big win for Viacom and
Google
that's the big win or for Google. I mean, yeah,
Google kind of fought this and said, look, we can do this, but we just can't give away personal information.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're stripping the personal information out of it.
Absolutely.
Which makes sense.
And,
a couple things though.
Yeah.
The whole stance that Google has on this is that we're not responsible for the content up there. That's fine, everything, but when it comes down to it, they are. I mean, there isn't porn, really, on YouTube. I mean, it's not as much as across the rest of the site. You'd think there'd be a lot more. So someone's getting rid of that. Why is that stuff getting
Well, because
not
users
there?
Will flag pornography, but users may not flag copyrighted material. If
okay,
you upload
so
the Daily Show, then the incentives are the people watching YouTube want it to stay up.
Hmm.
Except the Daily Show is now freely available on Comedy Central.
Well, that's true.
So.
That was an example, but that's true.
I finally went and started doing that, and it's great.
I'm
not buying through iTunes anymore or through Apple Store. I'm actually watching them for free with really bad commercials.
They are bad.
They're really horrible.
And another thing that I like to think about is how will these logs be delivered? Because it's over 12 terabytes of data.
I think they should zip them and email it.
on the contrary.
I read some comment posting that was saying, oh yeah, you know, they should just print it all out and deliver.
Right, the ruling didn't
Sachs
say what medium it would be in.
Nice.
So,
here's real spoken.
Yeah, just to spite them. But I mean, imagine preparing those logs, you know, and having to make sure that all of those...
They need to get some company that's really good with lots of data.
Exactly.
Oh, like Google.
Like Google. How about that? Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much, Ben, for that update.
Mm-hmm.
Writer, okay, actually, I want to go over to... I think I want to go to Miles, I think. Miles, what is TrueCrypt?
TrueCrypt is an encryption protocol, or an encryption product, I should say, that will allow you to encrypt your entire drive or encrypt a portion of your drive or just on a file-by-file basis. And
this isn't uncommon, but they do just think that's kind of uncommon. They hide
one
it,
One of
right?
the things they have is the idea of plausible deniability, which is they'll have an encrypted partition or an encrypted segment. And at the end of that encrypted segment, they'll have a second encrypted segment that, because the first one is encrypted, all of that data looks like random noise.
Right.
And so let's say you were being interrogated and say, we want that information, and you gave up your keys to the first one, then you can see inside that first encrypted partition, but prosecutors, in theory, would not be able to prove that you had a second section.
Interesting. So what you're saying is you can protect data from anybody viewing it. You can even make that data invisible so that it doesn't even look like it exists, even encrypted.
Right. And you can tell that you have an encrypted section just on a regular hard drive because you have this big file.
Right.
That's
really interesting. Okay, so what's the news?
But a luminary in the scientific community, Schneier, Bruce Schneier, has stated that there are holes in this in the functionality of the product. And it's not just a TrueCrypt-related thing. This is with all products that are trying to do this because plausible deniability is a hard problem.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why it's hard is because there are other applications at work on your system,
right.
such as
so
Microsoft Word.
When you use this TrueCrypt thing to unencrypt that whole section, it actually becomes viewable and readable like a normal hard drive. And then you open documents on it and you do things with it.
Right.
And so those applications have to know about it at some point.
Yes, and saving files to them is not a real problem. And once you unmount, then it goes away. It's just that Word does things like the autosave. And the autosave is not necessarily done on the encrypted partition.
Right.
It may be done, especially not on your private partition.
So if an investigator had a hard drive and they said unencrypt it, and the person only unencrypted part of it and the other part was hidden, and then you look and you find your autosave some Word documents that don't exist anywhere in the file system, you know there's more data there.
Exactly. And also links. whether they be like program links to other areas, are made all the time on Windows
right.
through installation software.
Well, yeah,
or
the registry holds information of like last saved locations, things like that too.
Right. And so that's another issue that they have to work on. And the new version of TrueCrypt, the way they get around that is when you mount that private area, it sets your other areas read-only.
Nice. That's a good fix.
So, but there's some question as to whether or not it solves all the issues, but
what
people
about,
are trying
Miles,
it.
What about just on that partition having a virtual OS? So you, that's the only thing that's there, and the TrueCrypt software actually also has an emulator that will run the OS. And then everything's self-contained.
You can have the whole drive encrypted.
Not the whole drive. I'm talking about you have a portion, and on that portion you have like a light Linux distribution. Well, any case, maybe we should start a business. Let's not get into that right now.
You'd still need to boot to it, though. You'd still need to have that extra. So
Yeah, of course. Well, thank you very much, Miles, for talking about TrueCrypt. Well, we now have, from Sweden, I believe, Tommy Olsen, co-author of The Ultimate CSS Reference. Welcome, Tommy, to GeekSpeak.
Thank you, Lyle.
What time of day is it there?
It's about 20 past 7 in the evening here.
All right. Well, it's about 20 past 10 a.m. here in California. Well, welcome to GeekSpeak, and thanks for joining us. I've been enjoying your book, and thought we'd come on. And, of course, it's a little strange to do such a technical topic on the radio, but can you give me a definition of first cascading style sheets, or CSS?
Well, basically, it's a technology or a language that allows you to define how a web page should be presented, covering typography, layout, colors, margins, everything like that.
So it's one of the main components to making good websites.
Yeah, basically, you have two legs. One leg is HTML, which defines the content and the structure and the semantics, and the other leg is CSS that defines how things should look.
In going through this book, I've used the Dynamic HTML book? What's that called? The one that was
the Definitive Guide, you mean?
The Definitive Guide to Dynamic HTML. It's a book that I've used for a long time, and this has a lot of similarities in its form. I think that the Dynamic HTML has CSS sections in it. I'm not really sure.
Oh, it certainly does. Yeah.
But this is actually also, you're covering some CSS 3 specs, even though that spec's not finished. Why did you choose to include CSS 3 stuff in this?
We decided to include the parts of CSS 3 that were implemented by at least one major browser at this time. We choose only certain parts of CSS 3.
Oh, I see. So if it's in Firefox 3, then you're kind of using it because it's going to be useful for developers.
Exactly.
What do you think is the most exciting part of the upcoming CSS 3 spec and its full implementation?
Well, for most authors, I think that the most useful part, at least, will be the new improved selector module. And that's a part that is really well supported already by Firefox and Opera and Safari.
And I think most people kind of understand what a web page is. It's a whole bunch of tags with content inside them. What CSS uses, you're calling a thing called selector. What is a selector?
Yeah, basically, CSS style sheet is made up by rules saying for these elements do this, for these elements do that. And each rule starts with a selector saying this rule will be applied to every element that matches this selector. So it basically selects which elements the rule will apply for.
So let's talk about like the GeekSpeak website for a second. If you go to the GeekSpeak website, there are headlines for every show title, and that's called an H2 tag. And so I don't know what color they are right now on the website, but the GeekSpeak website I think has orange, kind of an orangey colored. So today's show is the Ultimate CSS GeekSpeak. That's an orange tag, and that's actually inside the HTML document. It's an H2, or a headline, second-level headline. And you're saying that there's a rule that's specified in the document that selects off of that H2 and then does stuff like makes it a certain font, makes it a certain color, makes it a certain size. Okay.
So in that case, the selector is probably just H2, saying that all H2 headings should have this color and this font.
Okay.
Or you can be more specific. You can say only certain H2 headings should have this color. For instance, if you use an HTML class on it.
Yeah. So I'll actually give an example of that. On the GeekSpeak website, there's a whole bunch of shows. There's the ones that we're currently doing, and it'll pretty soon turn into our last show. And then there's recent shows, which are smaller, and they don't have as much information about them. And those, even though those headlines are both H2, they have different selectors that match them. But yeah. But you're saying that CSS3, the selector, the ability to select on something, is different. What's the enhancement?
The most interesting enhancement is probably that you can select various children of other elements. For instance, if you have a table consists of a lot of rows, mm-hmm. and it's quite common that you want to have, for instance, a zebra stripe table where you have alternating colors for each row.
Right.
And the only way to do that today is to set a class for every other row and style that class differently.
So you change the HTML to say,
yeah.
this is different than this, and therefore you
so
can select
you have
it.
To, you have to have that information in the HTML. But with CSS3, you can specify rules to say for every other line or other row, do this. Or you can even say for every fifth row except the first 10 or whatever.
Interesting. So you're able to select children counts, kind of doing almost math with the different elements on the page.
Yeah. You can say, for instance, the last four rows in the table should have this, or the last three elements in an unordered list, or whatever.
And I got a question for you. Is anybody implementing that currently?
Oh, yes. That's supported by at least Opera 9.5 and Firefox 3 and Safari 3, I think.
Okay. Miles, you had a question or comment? Miles has been doing a lot of research on, I guess you kind of got addicted to WebKit, which is Apple's Safari engine.
Started playing with the nightly engines because they've been pushing the envelope, it seems.
Yeah.
Yeah. Safari and Opera basically are doing that. They are heading in slightly different directions, but they are spearheading in their own separate ways.
So I have a question for you. Which browser do you prefer, this person who is an authority on CSS?
My personal preference is Opera. It's the most standard compliant one, and basically it's leading edge.
And you can get it on every OS.
Exactly. I use it on Windows XP at work, and I use it on Linux at home. I even use it on my mobile phone, Opera Mini.
Tell me, what's your day job?
I'm the webmaster for a company's house, or a Swedish company's registration office. It's a government office, basically.
And do you do the CSS?
I do the HTML and CSS.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, well, we are going to give away a couple of these books, and actually the way we're going to do this is we're going to ask listeners to answer a little quiz about the show we've done so far, so something about a news story or something of that sort. We'll be doing that in the second half of GeekSpeak. We're also going to be taking calls with questions and comments about web development today. So if you're building a site or you've got some technical questions, you've got at least one expert on CSS and a couple other flunkies to some degree, Miles and me. And I've got a big challenge for those web developers out there that might want a little challenge. The GeekSpeak website has a bug in Internet Explorer 5.5, I believe, on the blog section of the website. So if you want to take a peek and see what the problem is and send a diff to me or try to help out, we'll give you a little bonus and plug you a bit on the radio show. So there you go. there is one. That's one thing that's going on for me is that it's great to see all these new features of web development, these wonderful features. But when it comes down to it, it all comes down to install bases and who can view the content.
Yeah.
What's your general practice on that kind of thing? How do you do, for example, this government website? How do you determine what you can and cannot use?
Since we're a government website, we are prohibited by law from discriminating against citizens, so we basically have to make sure it's accessible to everyone. The information must be accessible. It doesn't mean it has to look exactly the same in every browser, mm-hmm. but at least you have to be able to access the information. We have a baseline right now that starts with IE6, i7, and of course Opera, Firefox, Safari, and all the standard compliant ones. We also try to do our best with Explorer 5.5, and even for IE5 for the Mac, but we do not put in a lot of work to make things pixel perfect for those browsers because the installed base is very small.
Right, but if you're using standards compliant markup like HTML 401 or XHTML, you end up even very old browsers that don't know anything about CSS should be able to see it. correct?
Exactly, exactly. You have to start with the markup, and then you add CSS as a second layer on top of that. So you make sure that it's logically correct first, and then you apply styling on top of that.
But that, okay. And I have to say that in doing that kind of thing, you've got to restrict yourself to older tools and abilities.
Well, yes and no. What you can do is what they call a progressive enhancement, which means you add features for those browsers that can take advantage of it and allow the older browsers to give a more bland look to the site. So you're not really restricted. You can't depend on the latest and greatest, but yeah. You can use it for added value.
All right, we are speaking with Tommy Olson. He is the co-author of The Ultimate CSS Reference, along with Paul O'Brien, available by SitePoint. You can find out more information at geekspeak.org. Stay with KUSP for Castle Cottage this morning at 11 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Dr. Don Motika, announcing OptimageHealth.com in Santa Cruz, providing personalized solutions to health concerns by combining conventional medicine with a wide array of functional medicine techniques. Details at OptimageHealth.com.
We are now taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800, or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Ryder called with a question. Ryder earlier in the show spoke about a news story about Diebold, potentially the CEO loading stuff into a district that might have modified the elections in the U.S. I want to know what state that district was in that Ryder was talking about. If you can answer that right now, you can call up GeekSpeak and tell us, and we'll send you a book of The Ultimate CSS Reference, a wonderful book about web development from the style sheet side. My SitePoint author, Tommy Olson, is joining us right now. The phone numbers are 476-2800. You can ask us anything you'd like about web development today. 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. All right, we were getting into... Well, we were talking about CSS stuff. Let's continue while we wait for calls. Miles, do you have any questions about CSS that you'd like to ask?
My favorite aspect of the new CSS specs that are coming out, CSS 3, is the fonts, being able to do custom fonts. Could you talk about that a little bit?
It's a difficult area because the problem is that to make this work, every visitor has to download that specific font to his computer. And that is a problem because most of the really good fonts are not in the public domain. They are copyrighted, mm-hmm. and you can't just distribute them any which way you want to. There are licenses and fees involved. So I'm not sure that this will be as useful as people perhaps would like to think.
Can you still do degrading specificity? Could you?
Yeah.
But that doesn't really solve the problem, yeah, right?
There are some fonts that are available for free, but at the same time, images and the like are also covered by copyright. I mean, the web page itself is covered by copyright, so mm-hmm. I don't know why fonts would have a extra special status here when everything else that you're downloading is also covered by copyright.
That's a really good example. Like if I put up a copyright image on my site and say for people to download it, I'm doing the same thing as if I included a copyrighted font. There's nothing.
Except
different.
Usually people don't make their own fonts. That's you usually make your own images.
But still, I can steal images and put them up on my site and distribute them illegally, if you will, copyright infringed, whatever. Just the same as fonts. So as long as the web developers are aware that they potentially are risking themselves and that they shouldn't do that, it seems to me it's a decision of the webmaster. So why is it such a pressing point, Tommy?
Copyright infringement is a big problem in many ways, but basically making a font entails quite a lot of work. So I suppose people who do that for a living really want to get paid for their efforts. It's a lot more work basically to create a good font than to take a picture. I'm not saying that you should steal pictures, of course, but yeah. but the amount of work involved is probably less for a picture. Right. Than for a phone.
So I guess one of the good solutions would be here is some repository of open.
There are a couple of them already of people who have donated a large number of fonts, and they also sell fonts, but they basically...
But see, the donated fonts thing, if there is a repository which would actually provide the URL for the font, the master URL for the font, if you will, and then as people visit a website that use that font, they download it once, then you don't have that issue of having multiple copies of the fonts. And is it going to be URL-based like the images are for caching, or is it going to actually install at a different level?
I don't know that they're that large compared to, your typical images.
I'm not talking about size. I'm talking more about issues of if you go on your personal site, talk about Times New Roman, and I talk about Times New Roman, assuming that wasn't on everybody's machine anyway, is the user going to download it twice? Because I'm really just specifying a file, and you're specifying a file.
Yes.
So what I'm saying is if there was a repository that says we are allowing this to be used and they're the owners, if they will, we use that URL, then you and I both tell our browsers, our users to do that.
Except
that
one URL might, or one site may have permission to use that font and another one may not.
Oh, that's an interesting idea.
So licensing would have to be on a site-by-site basis unless a font was completely free for use for all and in the public domain.
Interesting. The referral URL can be used, or the referral parameter could be used to determine that. It'd be kind of interesting. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. We'll go on with questions. Miles aren't getting
the reason why fonts seemed like a big issue to me is because a lot of people have done a lot of workarounds to do this. Most of the time, people make an image of a font, which makes the download that much longer. It takes that much longer to download, and the web pages end up being a lot more static, harder to deal with. You can't copy and paste.
We're going to go ahead and take a call, but Tommy, I do have a question for you. Maybe you can think about this before while we take this call. And that is, there's a lot of people out there that kind of feel like the pretty design of a website is not actually important. It's just fluff. So I want you to address that in a second. But first, let's go ahead and take a call from Salinas in California. Summer, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, thanks for having GeekSpeak. I want to find out if there's any sort of a prepackaged program that you can buy. For instance, I want to do something for semi-retirees like myself that are kind of shut in rural areas and exchange information on things of general interest to people like us, keeping healthy, keeping happy. I'm an animal lover. I am so gardening and this and that.
So you're collecting information and want to share that information with other people that in the same situation as you?
Yeah, but I want to find out, is there any way I can just like, you know, buy a pack program and just put it on my computer and, you know, just like, you know, 1, 2, 3 and it's up.
Yeah,
I think that simple. But.
Yeah, no, there is, actually. It's actually something that you don't have to install anything. You could just go to, Blogspot? It's a big blog company.
Well, Blogger is one of
Blogger.
Them.
Yeah. If you go to blogger.com, they'll allow you to create an account. And when you
there's Blogger, LiveJournal.
Blogger.com.
Blogger.com. Miles also mentioned LiveJournal.com.
LiveJournal, okay.
Yeah, MySpace could actually do this as well. Basically, they're services that you create an account, and then you get a URL which represents your account, and then you can share that around. And then you can post stories, and you can add calendar entries. There's all these features to it that allow you to add information. And you're the publisher. But you don't have to administer the servers or do any of that problems. And they make revenue off of advertisement that goes on the side. Though you can normally pay for an account that's a little more, that actually isn't free, that removes those ads. So it's pretty easy to do.
Yeah, it's kind of basic look and feel. If you want to tweak it and make it look better, you can. But otherwise, if you just want the information up, you can leave it as is.
So now, does that mean that they market your space, or do you have to do your own marketing and get... interest?
Well, the marketing thing you have to handle, but we have to remember that the way the web works, relatively soon after making an account there, Google will index it, Yahoo will index it, which means that it'll add that information to the search repository. And if you provide good information, good content, then slowly over time, and actually not necessarily that slow, you will start getting traffic. And as you get traffic, other people will say, oh, that was a good story, and link to you. And relatively soon, you should be an authority in your field, and people will be able to find you easily. And that's kind of how you do
it. Does that mean that then you can sell your ask for money for people to...
Asking for money for people for content online is a little tricky.
In other words, if I wanted to do it, I don't want to sound completely crass, But, you know, if I wanted, if I did, what, as you said, generate this thing and generate interest and so on, how could I then make revenue?
A lot of companies like New York Times are struggling with the exact same issue. So.
It's not a simple thing, actually, yeah.
Well, are there any organizations that you can hire to, you know?
Yeah, well, you can do the traditional kind of marketing thing, and then you can ask people for money. Via donation. That's a pretty common thing. You can actually receive income based off of advertising if you have a lot of traffic. For example, one of our geeks who is normally via chat with us, he's not always on air with us, his name's Alex Sleas, he's down south. He has a website called The Bearded Dragon or Bearded Dragon?
BeardedDragon.org.
BeardedDragon.org. And it's a forum, and he has a lot of information up there, and it's very useful to people. And he has a little bit of income that helps to subsidize that because of advertisement. So there's a way to do that. If you want to charge people for content, it's a little difficult to do, a little tricky. If you see the big boys that were doing that for a while, like Slate and stuff, they're not doing it anymore. So,
well, they do it for stuff after it expires after a while.
If
you want to look back at an article from a week ago or 2 weeks ago, then you have to pay.
But let me put it this way. I've been doing Geek Speak for Miles and I, and the geeks have been doing Geek Speak for like 8 years, and we donate and have a lot of content, and I'm not making 1 cent. It's all donation. So... If I'm not making money off of it, I'm probably the wrong person to ask how to do it. Thank you for the call.
Well, thank you.
Bye-bye, Summer. Okay, so, Tommy, you've had time to think about it. Maybe you don't need that much time to think about it. What about the whole, is CSS just making things pretty, and is that really important at all?
Yes, it is important because most people are very visual. We want things to look pleasing and... that generates an interest that makes people want to look at your page and maybe start reading the content as well. And there are other factors as well. CSS has a lot of things to help you control typography. And typography is very important for making things easy to read.
Mm-hmm.
If you use it right, if you use it the wrong way, it will be very hard to read. But, of course, we assume you do it the right way. And then you can actually enhance the readability of the text, make it easier for people to read, especially if you have a lot of content on your site. You don't want people to, you know, get tired after two paragraphs because it's so hard to read.
Yeah.
It is important.
What are some of the ways with typography that can help with this that are available in CSS?
You can control the font if you want to have a serif font or a sans serif font, for instance. Most people say that serif fonts are easier to read on the screen. That's the font with that don't have the little bits at the ends. Like Times Roman is a serif font, where Verdana is a sans serif. Most people think Verdana is a lot easier to read on the screen. You can also control the line height, which the typographers call the leading, the space between the lines. That makes it easier for the eye to, when you reach the end of the line, it makes it easier for the eye to find the beginning of the next line if the spacing is correct. You can do a lot of other things. You can make bold text, italic text,
so,
and whatever.
I think this concern comes from the overly flashy websites, and I guess it's kind of like the Times Square of web pages, when you have a web page that's so blaring at you.
Right, the descendants of the blink tag.
Yeah. And people just label that as, well, that's what CSS is. And in reality, it's completely not that. It's the ability to manage and design the tools
and with
necessary.
Everything, if you abuse it or use it the wrong way, it will be bad. You can do that with everything. But if you use it the right way, the way it's meant to be used, then it's a useful tool.
And what are your feelings on new CSS 3 proposals like multiple column?
I don't think that will be as useful as people think because it's not going to help you make multi-column layouts. It's more about breaking up one piece of text into multiple columns like in a newspaper. And, there are cases when that will be useful. But the problem with the web page is that you do not know how much vertical space you have to your disposal. Like you do in a newspaper or a book, you know the page is this size. And you know, when you put 5 columns in it, it will break here and here and here. But you don't know that on the web because you can never know how large the visitor's browser window is. So it will be difficult to make multi-column
but
text there.
Couldn't that be remedied by the media queries that are coming out as well?
Yes, it could be. You know.
Okay, well, it's very interesting getting into the details of it, but let's go ahead and take some more calls. First off, I want to remind people that we are giving away some books. The first question, I don't think we've had a win yet from it. We do have a winner for the CSS, so the question. Oh, I guess he's on air. Well, let's go ahead and ask him about it. All right, I get you. I got it. I'm on. Oh, no, he hung up. Okay. All right, well. Byron Pruntucky?
From Pruntucky.
Is that a place? Where is that? I don't know. Pruntucky. Any case, his answer was Dybul tampering. It was in Florida that might have taken place. That's what we reported on. So he'll get one of these copies of the Ultimate CSS Reference. And we're going to ask another quiz. Does anybody have a good...
Wait, Florida or Georgia?
It's Georgia.
Georgia.
Oh, it's Georgia. I just know they got it right. Sorry. So in any case, we'll thank you for answering that, and we'll go ahead and do another quiz here. Does one of you have a suggestion for a quiz on one of the news stories we had, or possibly on something we've already asked about CSS? Should we ask for, like, what a selector is? Is that a good question?
No. What is the metric for the number of creatures created in the Spore game? What number did it exceed?
Okay, so Miles reported on Spore, and the news story, actually the headline news story about that, had to do with how many Spore creatures, but it's because it passed a certain level that's larger than something else. So what was that Miles mentioned in that Spore? And if you answer that question correctly, you'll get an Ultimate CSS Reference, and the phone numbers to do that are 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800, or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, 1-800-655-5877. We are taking questions with comments about web development. You're welcome to call us with that as well. From Santa Cruz, Mike, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello. Could I try to answer the question first and then ask my questions?
Sure.
The metric or the comparison was it exceeded the number of known biological creatures on Earth?
Okay. I think that's a winner. Thank you very much, Mike. You'll get a copy. Oh, what we're going to have to do is have you call back right after you get off air so we can get your phone number and address, unless you want to give that to everybody in California.
Yeah. No,
probably not. Okay, so give us a call right back after we answer your question. What is your question?
A couple questions. First, sort of a technical question following up on the discussion on multiple columns. One thing that always surprised me with CSS is that I couldn't say I want my left column to inherit the height of, let's say, my content column. I couldn't sort of say whatever the content of the whatever the
size. You're kind of talking like, let's say you have a navigation bar on the left-hand side. Right. The navigation bar is 5 or 6 entries of navigation, and it's got a background color of blue. And then you've got your content on the main part of the page, and the content changes every single page, but you always want that bar to be the same height as the content. That's what you're talking about, right?
That's exactly right. So one ends up doing those kinds of hokey things like having a background
color of the content
that makes it look like it behaved that way. So, I don't know if there's a current solution to that or if that's something impending in CSS 3.
Tell me, can you talk about that issue?
Yeah, it is a very common question. And unfortunately, there are no really good answers for it yet, and there won't be in CSS 3 either, as far as I know. You can do the thing with the fake column using a background and on the parent element, but that's about as far as you can go. But my co-author Paul O'Brien, his site is actually very good when you have this sort of question, because he has examples of basically everything, how to do the 100% height and the inherited height and all that stuff. So I can actually recommend you to visit his site and look for examples on how to do this.
What's the site?
Oh, God.
Well, I can look up the book if it's in the book.
I don't think I'm looking in the book. I can't see it. It's pmob.co.uk, I think.
Okay, well, we'll do a search on Paul O'Brien, and we'll put it up on the GeekSpeak website on today's show. So geekspeak.org, Paul O'Brien has a website that's very useful in this kind of tricks and stuff. And there are some tricks. The thing that I think that's so interesting about that question from Mike, and I don't know, Mike, you're still with us, but it's so interesting is that prior to a real full implementation of CSS, before CSS was a big thing in web development, everybody was doing design layout using tables and these little one-pixel cells, and it was kind of a mess, but most of the web developers, myself included, got very good at it. And one of the things that it could do quite simply was make sure that the navigation bar on the left-hand side and the content field were the same height, because you wrapped it into a table and the table cells. So you did a lot of wrapping, which is kind of the same solution right now in CSS.
Yeah, well, you can do that with CSS as well, using the display table thing. But the problem is that it's not supported by IE yet. It will be supported in IE8. Mm-hmm. But it's not supported by IE7 or older, and that kind of makes it not very useful at the moment.
Mike, thank you so much for the call, and congratulations on winning the book.
Sure. I don't know if you have time for another question that's more open-ended.
Sure.
And maybe there's not a good answer for this one. I'm kind of curious about ways to approach having a common language or a common way of discussing design in the world of CSS, and especially taking concerns about accessibility. I think a lot of designers have grown up with table-based layouts, and even a lot of clients sort of look at sites that were exploited table-based layouts, and they say, oh, I want my site to look like that, or I want to design based on that approach. And in some respects, it creates, I think, a lot of problems when you actually want to implement the site cleanly, accessibly, and using better standards of CSS. So I just kind of throw that out as a how to have good discussions amongst all the stakeholders in development to get beyond old design practices.
Yeah. That, well, Mike, thank you. Hey, Mike, where do you work?
I work at UCSC.
Oh, cool. What? Yeah. Okay. I do, too. We'll have to say hi sometime.
Yeah, I met you in a meeting.
Okay. Great. Nice meeting you again on air, Mike.
And the URL for that example, CSS examples page, is, in fact, pmob.co.uk.
And you can get to that along with all our other comments about the page and about the site, the show and such, at geekspeak.org. Mike, thank you for the call.
Thank you very much. Bye now.
Now, I do have another question for our guest, which is, what are your thoughts on the work done by Dean Edwards, his IE7 script, making kind of massaging IE5.5 and IE6 into something akin to a CSS-compliant browser?
First of all, it's extremely impressive in terms of clever JavaScript. I never use it myself because I don't tend to do very complex designs that require that sort of thing, but it's definitely an impressive piece of work, and it was very, very useful, or still is, for making IE6 and older support a larger part of CSS too, basically. So the problem is that it adds some bloat to the page. It should be cached after the first call, of course, but it still has to be downloaded at least once. So there is a small performance penalty, and I think it can also make a performance penalty in the rendering because of how it works internally. But for most sites, it shouldn't be a problem.
Right. I don't know. I guess I'm of the opinion that slowing people down who are on IE so that their incentive to go to a, quote, faster browser. Oh, that's too slow for you? Oh, why don't you download Firefox or Opera or Safari, and that'll work out.
Well, it seems like interesting marketing. Look at it.
The book that we've been talking about is called The Ultimate CSS Reference. If you or someone else you know is doing web development, understanding CSS is a very crucial part of doing successful web development, web designing specifically. And this book's, I think, one of the best I've seen in a cohesive package to do that. And at the same time, I want to do a little bit of a rib, Tommy. The Ultimate CSS Reference sounds like it's done, only book you're ever going to need. But in reality, CSS 3 is going to get finalized one day, and you're going to get another one. Are you going to keep doing this? So you have plans of having a new book whenever new versions come out?
I think it will be updated as CSS develops, and that's the plan, I think, from SitePoint anyway. And I'd like to point out that the name was decided by the marketing people at SitePoint, and not by Paul and me. But and they like these hyperbole things like ultimate and definitive and stuff like that in their titles. But I think it's at this point in time, I think that the name is fairly descriptive, actually, because I think it is the ultimate CSS reference right now. Of course, it will be obsolete in a year or so, but there will be new editions which will continue to cover things as they develop.
Yeah. Here's another issue I've got in about CSS, and then that there's a whole bunch of... There's different levels of developers that do web development stuff, and there's the typical layers are kind of the designers and the implementers or the developers. And the designers, in some ways... Normally, the environments I've worked in are using an editing tool like Photoshop or something, a photo editing tool, Illustrator, or one of those type of beasts to design the sites. And then there's someone else that kind of implements that into CSS. Do you see that implementer of CSS as a designer? Do you see another role that really is the connection between the developer and the designer? How do you see that role?
It's probably a little bit in between, or you can also see it as a... The role of a designer has two parts. One is the actual graphic designer that does the image works, and the other part is the CSS designer that implements this in code.
Yeah, but isn't CSS code implementation kind of a programming level? I'm talking about like kind of conceptuals of how people's minds work. A visual designer type person might not have the logical necessity or the logical brain to do the more technical programming sense that CSS kind of is. So do you think there's a marriage, or do you see good people that are good designers that can handle, that can straddle both?
Of course there are. I mean, look at Dave Shea or Andy Clark or whoever. I mean, there are lots of great designers who have been able to master CSS. CSS itself is not very difficult to learn. There are some pitfalls and some complexities in it, yes, but most people can learn these things if they put their mind to it. The problem with CSS today is still the browser support matrix.
Yeah.
Especially Internet Explorer, that really lags behind everyone else. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what the IE8 will bring, because they promise, Microsoft promised that IE8 will be fully CSS 2.1 compliant. And if they manage to do that, then we have a whole new ball game, basically, at least in 5 or 10 years' time, when everyone has stopped using IE6 and IE7.
I feel like I've been, you know, doing web development, that's always the case. Like, oh, it's kind of difficult right now. It's going to get amazingly better. Just wait 2 or 3, 4 or 5 years. And it seems like that just keeps on happening. But then again, we do have an environment right now where CSS is completely used on almost every site. It is the way you do web development, which when it first came about was not. So it's definitely a success. Tommy Olson, thank you so much for being on GeekSpeak today.
Thank you, Lyle. It was a pleasure.
Tommy Olson is a pragmatic angelist for web standards and accessibility who lives in the outback of central Sweden. You can visit his blog at... How do you say this?
The Autistic Cuckoo.
Autistic Cuckoo, which is going to be available at geekspeak.org to find out how to spell that. Tommy, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And I really like the book, too. Thanks so much. The book is The Ultimate CSS Reference by SitePoint. Tommy Olson and co-author Paul O'Brien wrote that. You can find out... Thanks again, Tommy. Bye-bye. You can find out more information about our show, anything we covered today, by going to geekspeak.org. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. The geeks this morning were Miles Elam, Ryder Brooks, and Ben Jaffe. I'm Lyle Troxell. Thank you for your participation in GeekSpeak. Geeks?
Always a pleasure.
And thank you for listening to GeekSpeak. To those that called in, thanks for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without you, it would just be us geeking out. And who wants to listen to that? Our guest today was Tommy Olson. He's the co-author of The Ultimate CSS Reference by SitePoint. Broadcasting in HD radio on 88.9 FM, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Auto, on the web at kusp.org. See you next week. You just listened to another episode of GeekSpeak via our podcast. Would you do us a favor? Please go to your favorite podcasting index site, whether it be iTunes, Dig.com, Odeo, or another site, and write a review or give us a vote to let others know what you think about GeekSpeak. Thanks, that'd really help us out. GeekSpeak is supported by PreownedCar.com, PreownedCar.com, where anyone can post their vehicle for sale or browse to purchase a pre-owned car from other car owners. More information available at PreownedCar.com. This is Lyle Troxell for KUSP. Thanks for listening.